temper.
House Committee on Energy and Environment will come to order. All right, we've got a full agenda, and we are pleased to be joined at the beginning here by Representative Reed. So we will open a work session on House Bill 3030 and call him up. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, I'm Tobias Reed from Beaverton. I know you have a busy agenda, so I will not be here for very long. I know you had a hearing on House Bill 3030 recently, and I appreciate that. I'm sorry I wasn't able to be here. As you may know, we're expecting a new baby at our house, and that was the day that our my wife's coworkers decided to have a baby shower, so I wanted to get my
priorities
in order.
Where are your priorities?
Where's the chance to be up here for the work session? House Bill 3030, I think, is a good first step on needed reinvestment and realignment of brownfield redevelopment programs. During our in-district day a couple of weeks ago, we spent a bunch of our time in Beaverton traveling around looking at brownfield sites. Now, brownfield sites, I think, are typically thought of in more traditionally urban areas, but we discovered there are a lot of these opportunities in the Beaverton area, just as I suspect there are a lot of them around the state. So what this bill seeks to do is to enhance the grant and loan programs that Business Oregon and the DEQ run to recapitalize the Brownfield Redevelopment Fund. And in the Dash 3 amendments, we are somewhat reluctantly removing an effort for now to realign some of the property tax incentives. We're hoping that effort comes to fruition and perhaps in Dash 4s in this session, and if not, it's an effort I think we'll continue in the interim to provide both the incentive and the resources to redevelop and clean up these brownfields. There are just really significant and terrific opportunities. I understand Amy Siberian was here last week who successfully redeveloped an abandoned gas station into what is a real hub in the Beaverton area. It's the place I hold my constituent coffees. It has had a really tremendous impact in the Beaverton community, and I think that's just one example. So I appreciate you giving me a chance to come up. I hope you'll adopt the Dash 3 amendments and send the bill on. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Questions? Representative Reed. You've wowed us.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Colleagues, I believe with the Dash 3s, this bill is ready to go on to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendments dated April 9th, 2013. This is to House Bill 3030.
Vice Chair Johnson moves to adopt the Dash 3 amendments to House Bill 3030 dated April 9th, 2013. Is there any discussion?
Mr. Chair, I have one question on...
Yes, Representative Widener.
It looks like on page 3, and it's at line 2, no more than 60% of the total amount of the Brownfield Redevelopment Fund in any biennium shall be awarded to persons who are liable with respect. I'm just wondering, could one person receive up to 60% of this fund?
Representative, would you care to comment on this? We're looking at page 3, line 2.
Mr. Chair, I apologize. I heard only part of the question.
I'm just wondering if 60% of this could be given to just one person.
I think we're looking at the sentence that says no more than 60% of the total amount of the Brownfields Redevelopment Fund in any biennium shall be awarded to persons who are liable with respect to the subject property under ORS 465255.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, I am not an expert on the way that the Brownfield Redevelopment Fund operates currently, but I read that sentence just as you do. My supposition is that there are a wide range of brownfield opportunities, and some of which are very expensive. It might be that one turns out to have a huge impact for the whole state. So I think I read that the same way you do, but I would be gladly corrected by someone from the department if there's anyone behind me.
And Representative, it's correct to say that this is existing statute.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I believe so.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Representative Benz.
Right, and quite possibly I'm not correct on this, but I believe what this is doing is a couple of things. First, I think it's trying to make it clear that at least 40% of the money will go to public owners, not those people who are liable for the cleanup. And secondly, I think persons means any number of, and thus this is an attempt to allocate 40% of the money to publics and 60% to those who are personally liable for the cleanup. I think that's what that's doing. Subject to anyone that knows better.
Thank you, Representative.
Okay, any further discussion on the amendment? Any objection to the amendment? Amendment is adopted. Vice Chair Johnson?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3030 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Johnson moves House Bill 3030 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Discussion. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to say that I think that $10 million is a mere fraction of the amount it would take to do something truly meaningful for the state of Oregon, given the incredible number of these brown fields. I think it's a step in the necessary direction. I would also say that it strikes me that this provides a huge challenge to those who are allocating this $10 million because there's so many people that truly need that help. And I would also say that I do hope that this is not viewed as a device to prevent cities from adding additional industrial land while we wait the eons to get the money necessary to clean up the industrial land that happens to be within the urban growth boundary. So I'm supporting this because I want to see more industrial land, but I don't want it to be viewed as a reason not to add industrial land to our cities.
Those are excellent comments, Representative. Echo them,
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Seeing no further discussion, clerk will please call the roll.
Representative Benz?
Aye.
Representative Gimbrough?
Aye.
Representative Reardon?
Aye.
Representative Dagan Peterson?
Aye.
Representative Whitener?
Aye.
Representative Whippet?
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Chair Bailey?
Aye. Motion carries. Bill is on its way to Ways and Means. And close the work session on House Bill 3030. Colleagues, I just want to announce for you and for those in the audience, we are going to carry over House Bill 3492. That bill will not be heard today and not be worked today. We will work that on Thursday. And we are joined by Representative Cameron. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2412. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, House Bill 2412 requires the Environmental Quality Commission to contract with a unit of local government or private individual, partnership, or corporation for purposes of conducting a motor vehicle pollution control system inspections, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's good to see you. Haven't seen you since noon. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, State Representative Kevin Cameron representing South Salem, East Rural Salem, Onsville, and Turner, and bring to you today House Bill 2412. I want to thank you for the opportunity to have the public hearing on the bill, Mr. Chair. Things have changed in the state of Oregon, and things have changed in the manufacture of automobiles and the ability for automobiles to reduce their pollution. And what this bill does basically is ask for us to look at ways to find efficiencies in our systems in the state of Oregon. And it basically would allow the department, Environmental Quality Department, to look and see if there are efficient ways out there, more efficient ways to deliver a current service that we have in a specific area of the state of Oregon. It has been something that we looked at last cycle, and I wanted to continue to keep the issue in front of us that we'll ask to see how we can make more efficiencies in our state and in the services that we deliver. With that, I will see if you have any questions that I probably won't be able to answer.
Thank you. Questions for the representative? A couple of folks signed up to testify here. Okay, seeing none, thank you very much. We appreciate you bringing the bill forward for consideration. Call up Palmer Mason and Andy Ginsberg. Gentlemen.
Yeah, Chair Bailey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm the Government Relations Manager with the Department of Environmental Quality. I have with me here Andy Ginsberg, who is our Air Quality Administrator. He's going to provide some background on our vehicle inspection program and on this bill specifically. So we appreciate the opportunity to come and testify. Thanks.
Chair Bailey, Vice Chairs Boone and Johnson, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andy Ginsberg. I'm the Air Quality Administrator at DEQ, and I'm here today to provide some information and express our concerns about House Bill 2412. As you heard, the bill would require the Department of Environmental Quality to privatize our vehicle inspection program. So first, I wanted to remind you that the privatization question has already been thoroughly studied. A 2001 budget note directed us to investigate privatization of the vehicle inspection program through an RFP process with oversight from the Department of Administrative Services and a report to the Emergency Board. The result of the study that a contractor-run program would actually cost more than the program that's run by DEQ, and some of the companies that were initially interested in bidding chose not to bid, and they told us that was because they didn't think they could provide the level of service that we provide at the fee that we were charging. The Legislative Fiscal Office reviewed our report and recommended against privatizing the program. The two main reasons noted in the recommendation were, first, that the emissions test would cost more if we had a contractor running it, and second, and probably more important, was that the legislature would be foregoing its ability to have oversight on the program in exchange for a system that would require modifications to contracts every time we wanted to change the program. For example, Oregon was the first state in the nation to switch from testing the tailpipe of cars to testing the onboard computer of cars, and that allowed us to reduce staff by about 50 in running the program. We were also the first state to come up with a self-service testing booth that can also dispense DMV registrations, and this will allow us to add convenience and expand capacity without adding staff. So with a contracted program, those changes would have required a buyout of the contract or renegotiation of the contract, or we would have had to wait until the contract expired and then implement them through the next contract. But with the state-run program, the legislature can simply approve those by approving a budget package. Contracted vehicle inspection programs have a number of other problems besides higher cost and loss of control. Contractors may implement cost-cutting steps that could affect the amount of air quality reduction that comes from the program. And as a result, the Environmental Protection Agency requires states that have contractor-run programs to have an extensive and costly oversight program. And this can also lead to a need for us to have complex and detailed, inflexible contracts. Often contractors will have low wages that results in higher turnover, so customer service can suffer. It's also unlikely that contractors could provide DMV registrations on the spot as we do. And finally, in a decentralized contracted program, where the repair shops do the test and the repairs, there can be questions about conflict of interest and the potential for consumer fraud. So Oregon's program uses no general fund. It's fully supported by our fee. Our fee of $21 has not changed since the 2002 privatization study, and in fact hasn't changed for 15 years. In contrast, the national average fee for testing programs is around $35 every 2 years, and some jurisdictions also subsidize that with general fund. Our test is free to motorists until they pass the test, whereas other states either provide one or two free retests or no free retests. And also we provide free voluntary tests for people who just want to see how their car is doing. DEQ is recognized as a national leader in innovation and customer service and vehicle inspection. We have very high approval ratings from our customers. Over the last 2 years, we had a 96% customer comment cards praising us for our service. We have convenient hours that include Saturdays and Wednesday evenings, and we also certify fleet operators so they can test their own vehicles, and we bring our mobile testing van to dealerships so that they don't have to bring their vehicles and wait in line at our stations. So again, privatization of vehicle inspection has been studied before and found to have higher cost and reduces the state's ability to quickly innovate when we have program changes. So thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Yes. Representative Widener.
I'd be kind of curious, just
because I know if I let DEQ into my district, I would be shot, first off. But I do hear quite a few complaints, so from different people waiting in lines on Saturdays and having to go take their car in, and they'd find it more convenient if they could just do it when they got their oil changed. And one of the other things I've seen, I'd be kind of curious, how many cars that are basically 10 years and newer ever fail the test? So two questions. Basically, one, how many people are filling out that customer complaint card? Because I hear a different thing from people that I meet on the streets. And secondly, how many cars fail that are 10 years and newer?
Chair Fairley, Representative Widener. We hand the card to every motorist that comes through, and we get a pretty high level of returns. I've just heard we had 50 cards returned in the last week at one of our test centers. So it's, you know, a lot of people fill out the cards. I could bring you in a box full of comment cards, and there's a high, very, very high percentage of them that are positive. As I said, 96% or so. I think what your experience is likely the case that a few people that are unhappy with the program or had a bad experience are more likely to contact a legislator. And we hear regularly from lots of people that are very happy with their service. In fact, people who have first moved to the state are just frankly amazed at how much more convenient it is here in Oregon than in other states that they're used to. With regard to newer vehicles, the purpose of the vehicle inspection program is to prevent failures, not to catch failures. The DMV sends out a notice 3 months before your registration is due, informing you that you need to, if you live within our test boundary, that you need to have your car tested before it can be registered. And today's newer cars all have a dashboard indicator light that will be red if the car needs service. So most people take their car and get it repaired before they come in for the test. Our information that we can pull from the car's computer tells us something like 20% of the vehicles are tested between the time when DMV sends the notice and when the test is due. And about 10% or half of those are tested within the month before the are repaired within the month before the test is due. So as a result, when the cars get to the station, they don't have a very high failure rate. But that doesn't mean that the program isn't effective.
Thank you very much. Okay, seeing no further questions. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you speak just a little bit about what process you might have used to determine whether, in fact, privatization could be less expensive or not? How was that determination made? Was that just that the agency run those numbers, or was there some other third-party entity that attempted that?
Chair Bailey, Vice Chair Johnson, we were directed through a budget note to do the study in a very particular way. We were required to put together a request for proposals, so we described the test as we conducted it at that time, and we asked people or companies to bid on running the program. We were also allowed to bid ourselves, so the comparison was a bid from DEQ against a bid from other companies, and the contract was reviewed by the Department of Administrative Services and again by Legislative Fiscal. Mm-hmm. So that was the process.
Okay, thank you.
Briefly, Representative Whitsitt.
I was wondering how many FTE DEQ employees work on the program?
Approximately 90, Representative Whitsitt. Chair Bailey.
And a follow-up, if I may. Do you take into consideration the cost of PERS and the benefit packages in addition to the salaries that you're paying those 90 employees when you determine what the cost is?
Representative Bailey Cho Whitsitt, absolutely, yes. Okay. It's fully loaded cost.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Call up Robert Anderson and Ralph Groner, please. Whoever would like to begin.
Are you older? You can go first.
I'm sure I'm older.
Okay. Doesn't matter.
Chair Bailey and Council, my name is Bob Anderson. I own an auto repair shop over here on 13th Street, not too far from here. So I'm here today representing the Northwest Auto Trade Association and its 500 or so members concerning House Bill 2412. I'm on the NATA board of directors, and I chaired that board for several years, so I have a fairly good understanding of how shop owners in our state do business and how they think. And I've been in this business myself for 37 years, so I think House Bill 24 on the surface is kind of an interesting concept. However, I think there's really a great deal of work and research that's going to be need to be done before we can actually determine if it's really feasible in the marketplace. We look at Washington and California. They have varying degrees of shop licensing, but they do have licensing requirements that all auto shops have to meet. In Oregon, we have none. Our model would look very much different than either one of those two models if we were actually going to move forward on this. So in Oregon, there's, I don't know if you guys are aware of it, there's, you can open an auto shop any place. There's absolutely no licensing requirement whatsoever. There's nothing that suggests a level of competency in our industry. There's nothing governing the kind of tools we use or the level of training. So there's no medium that anyone could use to bench whether or not this concept would actually work. I've done some looking at some other states that have shop licensing, and it's not really the state that sets the criteria for the licensing. It's peers in the industry and trade association groups that set that standard. And in Oregon, unfortunately, our group has almost no experience from state licensing or for state licensing because we've never had it. So the DEQ really offers the best deal to consumers, and Andy mentioned this because this is really kind of an important piece of it. If a vehicle fails and goes out to be repaired and comes back, the DEQ will retest it for nothing. I'm not quite sure how that would work in the private world, because when you have a vehicle that turns on a check engine light and there's a component failure and you repair it and reset the light, it's not at all uncommon for that vehicle to go out through several drive cycles or so many starts, depending on the vehicle, and turn that light on again because there is another component that's failed as a result of that initial failure. So there's just a lot of things about this that would require a lot of work to figure out whether or not it could go forward. But our trade association, the Northwest Auto Trade Association, as well as many of our members, are willing to meet with the DEQ and those other stakeholders in this and see if we can find some answers to some of these questions. Do you folks have any questions?
Thank you very much. Let's go to Mr. Groner, and then we'll take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of this most wonderful committee. For the record, my name is Ralph Groner, representing, for those of you who don't know what AFSCME is, it's American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. For the record, we represent about 90% of the counties in Oregon and 90% of the cities. We're really a local government union compared to state. However, I happen to have not only the cities and counties, but DEQ. When I first heard, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, about 2412, I was kind of in shock, and Andy Ginsberg approached part of it. I'm in shock that a governor of this state would even not be here to testify for the shining light of state agencies when it comes to your vehicle inspection program, which has won national awards. I've been through three or four of these privatization things, and I look at the membership, and not one of you were a legislator when it occurred. Now I know why I'm in trouble. So I'm going, and secondly, only four legislators on this committee live in the geographical boundaries of the vehicle inspection. So the others probably I can understand wouldn't understand why we had thousands of cards came in from the public saying they wished this was how all state agencies operated, and this, quite frankly, the 90 people who work there are a significant reduction in the job workforce we did have, but our dynamometers, that's where the car got on, are gone. They've approached it at lowering the fees compared to anyone else in the country. My friend Wayne Scott formerly a representative, one time tried to sweep my fees away from my agency, and I said, Wayne, do you realize that when I was here, we actually put that in so we never had to increase the fees of the citizens in Washington, Clackamas, and Multnomah County? So he said, I didn't know that. What I want to say, you have my flyer. We've been through this. We've had national studies. The bottom line really was the private sector came in. One of them was got broke, went to prison. You forgot to tell them that, for corruption, a national. Then we ended up with service stations, excuse me, in California and other states, where you came out after you got your vehicle inspected. The investigation showed that you have owed more money because they had some repairs they had to make. Sorry, just absolute necessary. What you have in Oregon, yes, 90 employees, but I put their salary with me at least. They're not rich. These people make at the most at top five steps about $36,000 a year. At the bottom, they begin about 20. That may be high to some of you, but it's not to me. It helps feed a family, and hopefully they're allowed to either rent a lower-cost home or maybe have a small house. So the fact is, our members of my union are proud to say that they have the overwhelming support of Portland metropolitan people. I'd like to see another agency have that pride. I'm not here to disparage the governor, except that if I were governor, and heaven knows I couldn't even be a rep again, so I want to apologize for that. But the fact of the matter is, I'd be down here bragging on a state agency that the publicly supports as much as this agency, so I can run in there, get my inspection. Of course, now I own a Prius. I don't have to go there again. But I do have a granddaughter who lives with me, and the little Honda Civic's an old one at 250,000 miles, and I pay for that. She goes through the inspection, and I can tell you that we looked at privatization everywhere. We went through every hoop on this thing, not just once. And this has been researched and researched, and what you end up is the model in this country. And I want to say I praise my employees. They pay my salary, so I have a conflict of interest. It's about time I said that. And I want to say thank you for listening to us, and we hope you could say, in terms of time management, I took a course once, Portland Community College. That's why I went to 2 years. I had to throw that out.
And in that vein, if you could conclude your comments, that would be great. Thank you.
Stick with what your priorities are. And quite frankly, folks, I think you have a whole lot of priorities higher than this one right now. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Groner. Questions for this panel? Okay. Seeing none, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Okay. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2412. Announce that we are going to carry over the public hearing on House Bill 3011 to Thursday. Open briefly a work session on House Bill 2938. Colleagues, 2938 is not ready to go, and it will not be ready to go this session. I want to announce that I am continue to be supportive of the concept of increasing recycling rates, especially and making sure that our electronics are adequately and expediently recycled. And it is my hope that we will convene a work group in the interim to continue to explore this issue and bring parties together. And that is all I will say on House Bill 2938. With that, close the work session on House Bill 2938 and open a work session on House Bill 2005. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, House Bill 2005, the committee is being asked to consider the Dash 2 amendment. The Dash 2 amendment replaces the measure. It provides legislative findings, increases the number of construction industry energy board members to 11 by adding two members each from the state plumbing board and mechanical board, requires a 7-member approval to recommend adoption of energy construction standards to the director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, requires inclusion of one insulation craftsperson to the mechanical board, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage.
Call up Mark Long, please.
Good afternoon.
afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Mark Long, Administrator of State Building Codes. First, I want to start off and recognize Speaker Kotek's interest in mechanical insulation and recognition of the energy savings and the issues around. I think you had a pretty robust hearing on this a few weeks ago around insulation. What this bill brought to our attention kind of illustrated the fact that we have an existing system of looking at these codes and standards at building codes, but we didn't have everybody at the table. So we brought forward amendment to you that takes the existing construction energy board that my organization was created in 2009 through House Bill 2950 and adds more members from the mechanical board that we have and from the plumbing board to make sure that when we're looking at energy issues, we have the electricians at the table, we have the plumbers at the table, the mechanical officials, the commercial builders, the residential builders, my organization. And the hope with this measure is that as we get everybody at the table through this board, that issues of educating the local inspectors, design, contractor installation standards, the things that were kind of talked about in the previous hearing, can be discussed by this board while we're adopting the codes and standards and the regulation of how buildings are inspected statewide. So with that, I think this is a great amendment to the bill, and it provides a kind of a comprehensive one-stop place to discuss these issues. With that, I'll be happy to take any questions.
Great. Thank you for your work on this, Mr. Long.
Good.
Questions? Representative Widener.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I get a little nervous about adding some of these because we're pretty strict on where we are with a lot of our standards right now. And when we get into residential and commercial buildings, I just worry that we might get to a little overkill with some of this. I'm just wondering, with adding this to the board, do you think that there could be some battles that start happening there on where the code should be and everything, because we already have stricter codes than what the federal government has already on mechanical insulation. So,
Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, yes, of course, there always can be battles. Let me give you a little context about how this board works. Right now I have, I believe, seven boards at the Building Codes Division who are broken across those program areas, electrical, mechanical, et cetera, and they adopt codes or review codes on a three-year basis. This board is designed that when it's an energy issue, we have two representatives from those boards at the table. And the idea is if we bring an energy provision that maybe touches more than one craft and you have everybody in agreement, then you can have one-stop shopping versus, in my case, I'd have to run the issue sometimes between a plumbing board, mechanical board, a boiler board, the crosses pass. So this really wouldn't get at the substantive side of changing the standards, in my view. It's really going to make the system more efficient and make sure the folks that are need to be at the table are at the table to kind of hear about what's going on in the industry. So that's really, it's really kind of an efficiency board, and it was a brand new concept we created in 2009. If you kind of read the existing language there, it talks about two members have to agree, you have to get to seven votes out of the 11. It's really set up to make sure that it's a collaborative process. Much more than the current system.
Yeah. Now I'm going through and I'm looking at that, but I'm just thinking about different industries because this is going to affect different industries. I mean, what happens in the food processing industry where you have to worry about contaminants getting in food and things like that? Everything has to be stainless steel.
Sure.
There's lots of parameters there with the grease oils and even insulation. Can it be there? Can it not be there? So we don't have people from all these different industries coming into play that know all the background on this. We're going to start putting regulations on people that may not pertain, because everybody wants to be more efficient in these industrial environments, and we might set standards that may be going against what the food processing industry needs to happen with their equipment, if that makes sense.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Widener, I'm just on the food processing. My understanding is on the code side already from the national codes, a lot of that's left up to the manufacturing equipment because it is so unique in processing that really when you talk about mechanical insulation, the things that we regulate, you're talking about the building systems, HVAC, et cetera. And that's more comes down again from the national code bodies. We happen to use the International Energy Conservation Code in Oregon. We work through those various boards, and I guess I'll just try to hit home again. I probably haven't been very clear. The purpose of these boards is to get the right people at the table before the codes are adopted, and just to give you a little bit of background about how they work. When the codes come out nationally, they're reviewed by a committee that the boards put together. Then the boards will take a vote on it.
If it's an individualized matter, it goes to the mechanical board now, or it'll go to the structures board, which is the commercial folks, or electrical board if it's an electrical issue. If it happens to be an energy issue that touches more than one area, we believe we have consensus, it can go to this group. And then at my level, I can't act until the boards or the industries who we regulate act first. And so this really has been a pretty good system for the last 40 years. We're actually going to celebrate our 40th year here in May about a predictable environment, making sure that our stakeholders are at the table. And the important piece of this is when we worked on the bill in 2009, creating the board, for some reason the plumbing industry and the mechanical industry didn't get brought into that piece, and as we started looking at mechanical insulation matters with the speaker, we realized that we should get those folks at the table so that we get that level of input that you're talking about, and then we modified the makeup to make sure that folks who are involved in insulation are on that board as well. So I have given you a lot, but I hope I've answered your questions.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Long, first of all, I just want to say that I very much appreciated the testimony we received from you, not just in this committee, but in other committees this session. You've got a very pragmatic way of looking at issues, and you're one of my new favorite department heads, so just that to start with. But to get to the intent of the bill, could you speak a little bit about what currently is on the books regarding mechanical insulation standards? Because we started off, the original bill inferred that there was like virtually nothing out there, but I think that there are some things out there. So could you speak a little bit, you don't have to go way into detail, but talk about in a general sense what kind of standards are on the books already regarding mechanical insulation in commercial codes?
Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I can give you my best. I'll get over my skis. I'm pretty good at the policy side, but the technical side, I'll have to pitch it to the staff I have in the audience if we need to go further. In Oregon, just as a macro issue on energy efficiency, whether it's on the buildings or the insulation, we're one of the top five states in the country as far as how progressive we are with energy efficiency, and that whether it's in residential construction, commercial construction, or mechanical insulation standards. We are current with all the regulations. We have to certify to the federal government where we're at. We've met all the standards. I actually have our codes reviewed by an independent lab to make sure we're up to speed and we're progressive. So when this bill first came out, candidly, I think that if you look at nationally, about two-thirds of the building departments out there haven't taken proactive steps on insulation, haven't recognized the value of and the return on investment in some areas, not all areas, as Representative Widener points out, of having these robust standards. And so I think the Speaker's office and others who were looking at this bill wanted us to have that dialogue. When we began those communications and showed that we're current here in Oregon, we're ahead of most folks, we're very proud of that record. We started talking about what were some of the gaps, and you heard about value engineering, I think, in your testimony a couple weeks ago. You heard about inspectors. You heard about enforcement. And so the thinking behind this amendment was, instead of trying to solve those specific issues, not understanding the problem in total, is do we have the right people at the table, and is the structure in place through this board to discuss these matters? And so that's why I brought forward with the Speaker's office this change, because we think it's going to help make sure that the folks who are involved in these industries have a seat at the table, understand the issues, and where we can make improvement on inspector training and whatnot, we'll do that.
Okay, thank you. Follow-up?
Follow-up.
Mr. Chair, Section 3 then, okay, what you're proposing then is to take the existing board from 7 to 11, is that right? The Construction Industry Energy Board, by mm-hmm. adding the two members that are reflected then in Section 3. You get to Section 5, and we're talking then about the mechanical board that's already in place, right? It's a 9-member mechanical board. You propose, I think, eliminating one building official and substituting one insulation craft person.
Correct.
Why would you want to eliminate the building official from this board?
If you, Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, if you look at the requirements of what this board does, it's really kind of a technical board adopting codes about mechanical devices and equipment, and no disrespect to the building officials out there. I'm a building official. I don't have that knowledge. So if you look at kind of the knowledge base, we already have a mechanical inspector who has that kind of technical knowledge there. You have a public member. And then I personally believe you should have the industries, as Representative Widener is talking about, at the table reviewing these that have that knowledge and are impacted by whatever standards they recommend.
So my concern of eliminating the building official might lead to less pragmatic, let's say, decisions by this group is not founded, that at this point in time, your feeling would be that they're not necessary here, they're more useful over here in this other.
Yeah, I'm Chair Bailey, Representative Johnson, I'm not concerned about it. And again, the way the system works is I'm the final backstop on what comes out of the boards. It's a similar role to the legislature. I don't act until it gets through the boards first, and my choice is to accept or reject the
Thank
proposal.
Thank you, appreciate it.
Representative Bennett.
Your favorite person, just very department head.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Mark, is that on page 3, line 16 and 17, can you explain what that does?
Page 3. Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, because we added the plumbing board to the party, if you will, of the energy board, that we needed to be able to pick up their authority to recognize products and fixtures. So let's just, again, I'm going to give you a hypothetical completely off the top here. I hope that this doesn't come back to bite me, but let's say that there's an energy-efficient water heater of some sort that has a mechanical component, an electrical component, a boiler component, and a plumbing component to it, and that's a plumbing product. Instead of going to all four of those boards, which is my current world, if I brought it to this board and I got 7 members of the board to agree, and both members of the plumbing industry that was impacted by that, and the boiler industry, and whoever else I used in my example, then I could move that issue onto my desk for formal rulemaking. So it's to pick up the authority that the plumbing board currently has over these issues so that the energy board, if they get agreement, can take action on them.
Well, and I'm moving up that same page to line 7. It says approval by 7 or more board members is required in order to recommend adoption. How often do you not do what this board tells or suggests or recommends?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, I don't think this board at all. I have disagreed with some of our other boards here recently, which has caused us to have some in-depth discussions, I guess, between the industries. So, I mean, it's all over the place. I'll tell folks, you know, sometimes there's a public policy safety issue that folks aren't moving forward that I'd like to see there. Sometimes the regulations, I think, are over the top, and we need more time, which is the case in this last time, for industry to get caught up and to be trained adequately. So it really kind of depends on the issue.
All right. Final question, Mr. Chair.
Please.
I'm not supportive of this, but I would support it if you will promise never to leave the department, because I share the Vice Chair's view of your competence. So if we could put that amendment in here, I'd support it.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chair. Representative Bentz.
Plus, we don't want you drawn on PERS.
Ah, thanks.
Further questions? Okay. Thank you. We appreciate your testimony.
You bet.
All right. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the -2 amendments dated April 11th, 2013 to House Bill 2005.
Vice Chair Johnson moves to adopt the -2 amendments dated April 11th, 2013 to House Bill 2005. Discussion on the amendment.
Mr. Chair, actually this amendment's a lot better than where we started. So I'm glad we're adopting it to it. So it doesn't necessarily mean I'll be supporting it, though.
Thank you, Representatives. Is there objections to the amendment? Seeing none, amendments are adopted. Vice Chair Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2005 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Vice Chair Johnson moves House Bill 2005 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Mr. Chair, I won't be supporting this just because, I mean, we're doing a very good job on the insulation. I mean, I just built a house. I've actually supervised insulators in industrial plants. Very familiar with this issue. Most plants, I mean, every plant I've been into is doing their best to do this because they know the energy that's lost from it. Air leaks is actually a bigger problem, much bigger problem for energy loss than the insulation costs. So I just worry that we might get carried away on regulations that we might be putting on people. So.
Thank you. Seeing no further discussion, Vice Chair Johnson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, thank you. The -2 amendments to me are much more palatable than the original bill. I can see some value in adding these people to this board to be able to provide that sort of practical input during the code-making process. So, thank you.
Thank you. Clerk, please call the roll.
Representative Benz?
No.
Representative Dembrough?
Yes.
Representative Burden?
Yes.
Representative Vega Peterson?
Yes.
Representative Wagner?
No.
Representative Whitsitt?
No.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Yes.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Chair Bailey?
Aye. Motion passes. It's on its way to the floor. Representative Johnson, would you be willing to carry?
Okay, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Appreciate it. With that enthusiastic response, close the work session on House Bill 2005.
We get a black jacket, too.
And we're going to move to open a public hearing on House Bill 3491. Adam?
Chair Bailey, members of the committee. The committee is being asked to consider the Dash 2 amendments to 3491. The Dash 2 amendments replace the measure. They require the governor to report to the Legislative Assembly regarding the status of the Columbia River Treaty 2014-2024 review, as well as any participation or input of the governor or any state agency in the Columbia River Treaty 2014-2024 review. It requires the reports to be filed quarterly from 2013 to 2014, starting on September 15, 2013. It requires the reports to be filed annually from December 15, 2014 to December 15, 2025, declares an emergency and is effective on passage. This measure, these amendments have no revenue impact nor a fiscal impact.
Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you so much for hearing this bill. Members of the committee, Cliff Benz, District 60, appearing to bring to you the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 3491. Members of the committee, I've worked in the water area for many years and have heard about the Columbia River Treaty, of course, for the years I was on the Water Resource Commission, and more recently as I've attended many of these meetings. As you can see, and maybe you read the Oregonian this morning, there is now actually a meeting going on as we speak in Portland reviewing the negotiations that are now ongoing. And of course, many of you have seen this Columbia River Basin map, and you can see the size of the problem facing us as we renegotiate the treaty, which could be terminated as early as January of next year. I doubt that that will happen. And the concept, of course, is that 10 years notice have to be given before the treaty can be terminated. This is a reflection of what happened some years before the treaty was enacted. There were, I think, 12 or 13 people drowned in this flood. The idea is, going back to this slide, that we try to hold the water up so that that does not repeat. The treaty allocates responsibility for the drafting of reservoirs so that we know how that risk of possible flooding might be shared. That that is going to be, and is in some of the discussions now. In fact, when we had the flood event some years ago, the reason that the Willamette was allowed to spill on through Portland without all that water coming down the Columbia is because it was held back under the treaty provisions. So this gives you some key dates of the treaty discussions. You can see that the treaty was signed in 61, ratified in 64, and thus you can see that 2014 is the latest at least a 10-year notice can be given. And so and then the termination would be the earliest, 2024, that it could be terminated. Moving through this pretty quickly, Mr. Chair, so because I think you should have all been handed a packet of material.
Yes, we have been.
And so there's no reason to spend too much time on this other than to say that there is much discussion about this ongoing. It's incredibly complicated. It involves, of course, our four states of Idaho, Montana, Washington, and Oregon. All have been involved, and our governor's office has been doing an admirable job of representing our interests, I'm happy to say. But I think it's important that this group, this legislative body, be kept aware of and participate in those discussions. They are hugely important for many aspects of that river and our Columbia Basin. So it is my hope that under the Dash 2 amendments, folks will have a chance to listen to how these issues right here are being addressed and weigh in on them. You can see that I have suggested in these amendments that we get receive a report on December of 13, and then, of course, going into next year. The reason? Because we have to kind of let everybody know what we're doing in the next 6 to 7 months. And so I think it's super important that the governor has already held one information meeting here in this building about a month ago, and I'm sure that they will be keeping us appraised of what's going on. Why? Now, these are my summarization of the issues. I actually put this together about a year ago, and I would say that as the conversations have continued, some of these issues aren't as important as they once, I think, in my mind, were. I will simply say this is a great big deal, and it's super important that we as a group be kept appraised of what's going on. Enormously complicated, enormously meaningful for our future, and I hope you adopt the Dash 2 amendments. Happy to try to answer any questions. I know we have, I think we have someone here from Bonneville Power, but I don't think they can speak to us today for reasons having to do with, I think the thought that the Corps and the BPA speak at the same time, and all we have here today is, I think, BPA. So they're here listening, but they're not going to be talking or answering questions. So that's to my knowledge. I may be wrong. So with that, questions?
Thank you, Representative. And is it fair to say that the intent here of this bill is to make sure that the legislature is able to keep tabs on this discussion and understand the policy issues that are arising in the process of this renegotiation?
Mr. Chair, that's exactly right. And to hear the explanation from the governor's office of the types of trade-offs that are being made almost as we speak, because they are extremely meaningful for the future of this state. The timing of the flows of the water coming out of Canada, hugely important. The allocation of the risk of who's going to draft their reservoirs so that those floodwaters can be captured, because Canada may not want to do that. The possibility of there being a substantial amount of value arising from the $200 to $300 million a year that currently is being paid back to Canada for power generation, that there's some suggestion that will be a much smaller number in the future. So the question might be, who ends up with that value? And not might be, is. And so there's, and that's just a few of the many issues. One of the really interesting ones is the possibility of storing more water in Canada and negotiating the opportunity to maybe build another project or not, or to increase the height of those that exist. Many opportunities there, and I think it's in all of our interests to have this discussion. I would point out that my district is immediately adjacent to the Snake River, which is hugely impacted by these discussions.
And I would venture to say that whether the issue is public safety or irrigation or in-stream uses for ecological flows or electric power generation that affects the entire state, these are all issues of statewide importance regardless of proximity to the Columbia River.
That's exactly right, and the list goes on and on.
Questions for the representative? Representative Vega Peterson.
No, thank you, Chair. I just wanted to thank you for bringing this bill forward. I think this is very important questions, as you said, that are being discussed in this, and I think it's entirely appropriate that the legislative body be updated on what's happening in these discussions.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Representative Pearson. I would just say that the governor has been informing us. I thought this actually would raise our consciousness level of the importance of the issues.
That's a good point, Representative. Further questions? Representative Reardon?
Thank you. Would this include a study of the nuclear facilities that are located up the Columbia River from us and any flood potentials that...
My understanding, Representative, is not in this bill.
No. Okay. No. Thank you.
Vice Chair Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Benz, I think you've been involved in other discussions with our regional partners on this. Is that correct?
I have.
What's the aptitude or the interest in our neighboring states or our partners with what we're talking about here? Is there general sameness of, you know, we need to remain focused on what's going on? What's the interest in other states from your perspective?
Right. Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I would say their interest is extraordinarily high. And I think all of them understand, I talk about Washington, Montana, and Idaho, understand the enormous number of trade-offs that could occur in those negotiations as between our four states. Who, where will the responsibility rest for storing flood water, for example? Because, of course, if you store flood water, you've got to draft your reservoir and leave it empty. And thus you take the risk of and the cost of having let that water go maybe at, in an opportune time. Right. So this is a great big deal in those states, particularly in my conversations with those people from Idaho who are absolutely wonderful water water attorneys that I work with over there, and they are extremely concerned about this process. And I think the same is true for my water-related friends in the other three, the other two states. And so since I do sit on the River Governance Committee and have for the last 5 years, we've had this discussion a lot. And so I can attest to their involvement and their abilities. They're excellent.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Seeing no one else who wishes to testify on House Bill 3491, close the public hearing on House Bill 3491, open a work session on House Bill 3491. And while Representative Bentz is making his way back to his seat, Representative Bentz, do you have a motion for us?
Chair, I move adoption of the dash two amendments to House Bill 3491.
Representative Bentz moves the dash two amendments to House Bill 3491. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, amendments are adopted. Representative Bentz?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3491 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bentz moves House Bill 3491 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing none, clerk will please call the roll.
Representative Bentz?
Aye.
Representative
Representative
Burden?
Aye.
Representative
Biden?
Aye.
Representative
Whitehair?
Aye.
Representative
Whitehair?
Aye.
Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Chair Bailey?
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Bentz, would you like to carry?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. And we will close the public work session on House Bill 3491 and reopen the carried over public hearing on House Bill 2807. Reminder, colleagues, House Bill 2807 is a vehicle by which we will be discussing changes to the energy supplier assessment. And we'll be hearing about the energy supplier assessment from those signed up to testify. However, I want to tell you that we do not have amendments back on that bill that are ready to go yet. So we will be taking public testimony and we will be carrying over the work session on House Bill 2807 to Thursday. Is that sufficient notice, Adam?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay. Call up, and this is the sign-up sheet from last time, so there people may not be here. If they're here, Jeff Bissonette, Doris Penwell, Varner Seaman.
Chair Bailey, that community of people were told that the bill was being held over to Thursday. They're still in the building. I think we can probably track at least Jeff down.
Be happy to do that. I apologize for the miscommunication. The work session is being held over. We are continuing the public hearing. Okay. And why don't we have joining Doris, Danelle Romaine and Ted Case.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Doris Penwell, and I represent the Association of Oregon Counties. I'm here today keeping my fingers crossed for the final bill. So I'll speak conceptually about what I hope is in the bill, and I want to say that AOC and we involved on a long-time basis with the Department of Energy feel you're going in the right direction for establishing some processes and some input from advisors on how the department operates, how it does its budgeting, and how it communicates with the rest of the world. We've been, as I said, we and other entities have been involved with the department a long time, and they're a great agency, but they've grown up from being a small sort of, you know, mediocre in terms of importance agency, and they become much more important, and they touch businesses, individuals, associations, public entities, and it is important that they are able to communicate with all of us in a much better way. So I'm really encouraged by the work you're doing on behalf of the energy suppliers, on behalf of the programs that are in place, and especially establishing some kind of an advisory group that allows a regular and ongoing communication with folks. I think it's pretty clear that if something like this had been in place sooner rather than later, much of this discussion about how the department uses energy supplier funds could have been more easily taken care of. So I think you're for sure going in the right direction. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Ms. Pinwell. Ms. Romaine.
Thank you. Chair Bailey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Danelle Romaine, and I'm here today representing the Oregon People's Utility Districts Association. We're one of three consumer-owned utility associations in the state of Oregon. And our clients have been concerned about the use of the energy supplier assessment for a number of years now. We've watched this assessment grow from its original intention, which was to fund nuclear siting, to now basically funding every department within the Department of Energy, and that causes us a lot of concern, especially because the cap on what the department could use in terms of funding is seven times what they're currently using in their assessment. So the current assessment is 0.07%. The cap is a half of a percentage point, which is seven times that amount. So they're collecting about $10 million biennially now. They could collect $70 million. So those sort of numbers cause us a lot of concern. We really appreciate what Chair Bailey has done here, taking on this bill. It's a controversial, tough issue, and we really hope that we can get to a good conclusion here. We like what we've seen in some of the amendments that are going around in terms of limiting the use of the funds to the department. That's really key to us because we've seen those funds used to fund other departments in past sessions. We like the advisory committee that Ms. Penwell was talking about. We're still working on getting that cap down, and that's really key to us. So we look forward to continued negotiations, and thank you for your work.
Thank you. Mr. Case.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Ted Case. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association, 18 electric co-ops in Oregon, representing the rural and remote areas. I just want to echo what my colleagues here have talked about, and certainly want to commend the chair, who I know has put an enormous amount of time into this. Electric co-ops contribute about $250,000 each year to the energy supplier assessment, which is more than some, less than others. But the issue that I get from my members is, what are we getting, you know, for that money? And working with Lisa Schwartz, we're trying to answer that question for them to try to get more transparency, more accountability into that program. And I think some of the steps we've seen so far with some of the amendments is getting there. There's more work to do, and I know the chair is committed to that. One of the issues I just want to flag for you is we've seen recently with the department a tendency to get involved with our power supplier, the Bonneville Power Administration, which I'm sure they have the right to do. Sometimes we learn about it after the fact. Sometimes we believe that they've intervened with Bonneville against our interests. So what we're trying to do is develop a process, notification, so we're more of a partners in this with ODO rather than potential adversaries. So we think that the amendments are moving in that direction. Again, I think still more work to do. So commend the chair and look forward to working with the committee on the going forward. Thank you.
Thank you all. Questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. We appreciate it. Call up Jeff Bissonette, Beth Vargas Duncan, and Alan Tressiter, please. Mr. Bissonette.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonette, representing the Citizens Utility Board of Oregon. We represent residential ratepayers of regulated utilities. Here to talk in support probably of the bill, but definitely of the process. And I think, as you've heard, the process is getting close. And I think that we're going to have, at the end of that process, a deal that will increase accountability, increase transparency, and I think settle some concerns that that we don't necessarily share on the intervention, but you know, we certainly see that others do. I think that we're fortunate that we have in the new leadership of the Department of Energy and in Lisa Schwartz, an ally in the cause for transparency and accountability. You know, I think that you know, we were on this road before, but I think the statutory changes give give assurance to those of us where that's really important. And I think that, you know, we want to be careful in terms of putting the sideboards around the intervention, that we don't want to undercut that voice on statewide energy policy, but we want to make sure that, as you heard in the previous panel, that affected parties at least get some heads up that there's going to be intervention taking place and that sort of thing. But overall, a very good process. I think there's going to be a good result and a bill that will be in good shape and ready for your approval, and we'll be urging you to approve it. Thank you. I'm happy to answer questions at an appropriate time.
Thank you, Mr. Bissonette. Ms. Vargas-Duncan.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, I'm Beth Vargas-Duncan with Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities Association. We have 11 cities with utilities in throughout the state of Oregon. And I submitted written testimony previously on April 11th, so with previous amendments. So most of the points in that, I believe you have that in front of you today, are still pertinent. The only thing that I'd like to point out, I really appreciate the opportunity to join in the conversation with the governor's office, with the department. Very much it's refreshing to have the department head that we have. Although I'm new, I saw a little bit of the transition, and it's very evident that the new leadership is working well and making a great effort to hear our concerns. In regard to some of the testimony presented earlier from the People's Utility Districts Association concerning the cap, there's a lot of room for increase there, and that is an area that my members would feel greater comfort if that came down. So we'd like to continue that conversation, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have today, too.
Thank you. Mr. Trester.
Mr. Chairman, committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify. For the record, I'm Alan Tressiter, representing Iberdrola Renewables. We are the second largest renewable energy provider in the world. Our international headquarters are in Spain. Our U.S. headquarters are in downtown Portland. We are responsible for not all but almost all of the windmills you see east of the mountains. Let me be very frank about the energy supplier assessment. That's the only way I know how to be, so you all know that. One, I commend Director Schwartz for the job she's doing. It is a breath of fresh air, and I appreciate working with her and the information she gives her. I appreciate the governor's energy policy advisor and the work group that she's put together and the work they've been doing. I don't like the ESA, and here's why I don't like it. Sometimes more transparency just proves what you've always thought, that the Department of Energy is collecting a fee from us, an assessment, not a fee. We understand fees. We pay for things that state departments do for us to help site and the various things they do. This is an assessment. This is a fee which varies from year to year.
for something that has almost absolutely nothing to do with us. When we got the list of things from the director about what they use the ESA money to do for, it confirmed what I always thought. It really doesn't have much to do with us. You all, the Legislative Assembly, gives the Department of Energy tasks to complete. But this isn't a criticism, it's just the way it works. But you don't give them any money to do that. You just say, we want you to do X, Y, Z, but no, there's no general fund for you to do that. So you need to get that out of your own budget. One of the ways they do that is through the ESA. So they figure out the tasks they need to complete that you've asked them to do and other things they'd like to do. And then they assess us a fee that raises that amount of money. Even when the tasks that they are doing, I mean, we're a renewable energy company. We weren't here in the beginning when you wanted to try and site nuclear facilities. When windmills and other alternative energy devices became popular, a state senator who chaired the Senate Energy Committee decided we should be thrown in the briar patch too, and so we became subject to the ESA, just because there was going to be a lot of renewable energy. But still, if I had my first choice, I would take independent energy suppliers like us out of the ESA. If I had my second choice, I like the way that the director is going. She is being more transparent. She is providing us with information of what the ESA is used for. We have ongoing discussions. As Ms. Romain said, the cap is a critical issue, given the fact that they can assess a profoundly greater margin than they can now without much of an oversight by you all. So a cap becomes very important. So if we're going to continue down this path, which I assume we are, and if you won't take independent energy suppliers out of the ESA, then the way we're going is the right way to do it, with an advisory group, with a cap on the assessment, and with some ongoing and reasonable oversight by the Legislative Assembly on what the Department of Energy is doing with the money that they're assessing to us. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you for this panel. Questions? Representative Reardon.
Thank you. Alan, I guess you're the last one to speak. Could you talk about how you see the role of the advisory group playing out? I've heard a couple of different interpretations.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Reardon, it's actually unclear yet. I think we're negotiating that right now. Okay. We've met three or four times. I think the governor and the governor's staff is forthright about wanting our input, and that input hasn't been limited yet. So I see hope for that, but specifically what the role is going to be, I think that's still unclear. I think we're going to look at things like the magnitude of the assessment and the magnitude of the what they're going to use the monies for, and whether there's a cap or not, whether we need to change the cap, and those kinds of things. My colleagues might have some comments on that issue also.
Chair Bailey, Representative Reardon. Yes, this has evolved. This is something that payers of the ESA, at least some of us, have requested an advisory committee to help give the department additional input. But as we made that request, our original intent as payers was to have in statute something that would prompt the conversation between the department in the event that our current director, Lisa Schwartz, were to ever leave and we had a different type of director in the future, now that we've seen some of the past. And so we wanted to have a budgetary kind of conversation so that the payers could see and anticipate, are we going to have a 23% increase, or will it be less, or will it remain the same regarding the ESA? And as a part of that came out the advisory committee concept, which I think the director, and I can't speak for her, but for the department, I think it would be helpful for them to also perhaps have an advisory type of committee, which they can do outside of statute. She can gather that group together and receive input on a programmatic and other level. But really what my members were looking for, and as I understand the other payers were looking for, is a budgetary touch point.
Mr. Chair, Representative Reardon, just to build on that, I do think that the conversation is going into that sort of two-pronged area, really looking at the budget and having a regularized and institutionalized way to do that, and not only the payers, but it was important for me personally, representing an ultimate payer in terms of a consumer, to at least make sure that it happens as a public meeting and that it includes not only payers but other interested parties. And so, that's a part of the amendments that are coming. And then the advisory committee is more policy, programmatic type of thing, and less budgetary. I think there's going to be some crossover, but whereas the advisory committee, I think, was originally viewed as both, there's some specific issue on the budget, and then some more specific issue with probably some background coloring by the budget, but more focused on programmatic elements.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you want to add something more, Mr. Trister?
One more thing, Mr. Chairman, if I might. Jeff talking about customers reminds me that I wanted to tell you that Iberdrola and other independent energy suppliers, to the degree that investor-owned utilities and munis and others pass these costs on to customers, we don't have customers per se. We don't serve individual consumers. We serve energy companies like PGE and PacifiCorp, and large industrial customers who know what they know to the decimal what the price of electricity is at any given moment, and that's set, and we can't change that. So we don't have a customer that we can have the opportunity to pass ESA costs on to, and that way we're different from the other providers. And just add that to your consideration.
Thank you. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We've had this discussion before, but it's worth having it again because it's a big deal. The question I've asked myself is, what is driving the outcome of this? Is it that which you think the statute requires, or is it that which the department needs, or is it that which, I mean, where's the measure of how much this ESA is used for?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Benz, I can only give you my personal opinion. I think over the year, and I will exclude the current director because I don't know how she's going to operate. It has been my experience over the years that with many directors of the Department of Energy, this money became a fund to balance their budget with, and that the Legislative Assembly would give them tasks, give the department tasks to complete, and no general fund money would come with that direction. And so the department had to have a way to raise monies to complete what you all asked them to do. And one way they do that is through the ESA. And so the amount of money needed would vary from year to year. As Ms. Duncan said, one year it was 23% increase in the ESA. So I do believe that in past directors, this was a, pardon the phrase, it was a slush fund that department used to balance their budget. Now, I'll hold judgment on how the current director is going to do that, but that's my belief of what it was.
Follow up. Right. I understand that. My question is, let's ignore that for a moment, that history, and just ask, my question is, what should be the measure of that which comes out of that ESA money?
Well, it seems to me if you're going to assess energy suppliers, first the money should be used for something that has something to do with our industry. I mean, when you assess us a fee and then transfer it to a different department in state government, that doesn't make any sense. So there should be a relationship. We all know this from ballot measures and everything else we've worked on. For a tax increase to be approved, it has to have some relationship to the people you're wedding, what am I going to get of value? So as an energy supplier, what do we get of value from paying this fee?
Are you going to do something that helps our industry operate better? Are you going to do something that makes the department more efficient? I mean, there needs to be a relationship between the fee and what you're doing with the money. Right now, I would argue there is no such relationship. I don't know if that answers your question, Representative, but...
Hello, Mr. Chair.
Please.
I'm tempted to make a remark about the link between taxes and how we spend that money, but I won't.
You can go for it.
It may not be germane to this hearing.
It may not be germane. No, it's not germane. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Okay. Seeing no further questions, appreciate your testimony. We do have the director here. Would you like to come up and testify?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representatives of the committee, I'm Lisa Schwartz. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Energy. It's my pleasure to testify today on House Bill 2807. A bit unexpectedly, we were expecting that the hearing was carried over for Thursday, so apologize for my being late.
And to clarify, Director, the work session is held over, so that will be held over till Thursday.
Thank you. The bill represents the principles that underlie a group, Senator Edwards, Representative Bailey, and the governor's office put together to hear the concerns that the ESA energy resource suppliers that directly pay the fee, as well as the stakeholders, other stakeholders, the customers of those utilities and other energy suppliers had about the ESA as it's operated over the years. So the governor's office put together a stakeholder group to try to look for some of the potential solutions today in this bill, and also going forward to have a sounding board for future refinements and bringing forward additional concepts. So you've heard already, I believe, that the bill would establish an ongoing work group to serve as a sounding board on our budget, on our planning and policy work, to require the department to provide program-level budget information. We've heard this time and again since I've been director for just 4.5 months, stakeholders really wanting to get down and understand on a program level what the budget is for each and every one of those programs and which portion ESA is going to cover. And I'm committed to providing that level of transparency for stakeholders. Also, there's been some concern about being notified and some of the uses of ESA funds, and I think the policy here is no surprises. I would hope as director that I would have very good one-on-one relationships with all of our stakeholders and provide constant communication and get constant feedback. At the same time, there was an interest in having some institutionalization of that process, to have really a sounding board and a way on this advisory committee, but also to have some official notification of the department's formal intervention at state proceedings in particular. And this bill, when finally amended, is expected to do that. Also, making sure that it's very clear that any such intervention is at the direction of the director, we are already institutionalizing a very formal process within the department, so it's very clear that it's always at the director's direction. House Bill 2807 also would reduce the cap, the maximum level that can be charged to the energy resource suppliers. Today it's 0.5%. In the bill, the cap or the maximum allowable amount would be 0.375%. In addition, the bill would make a couple process improvements. We use this opportunity to bring it up to the current age. We could use electronic invoicing instead of requiring certified mail, for example, and also would give energy resource suppliers a choice of using a calendar year or their latest fiscal year, and that would get us toward meeting a recommendation by the Secretary of State's office to have audited gross operating revenue reports by the energy suppliers. So this would be the least burdensome way of doing that. If they've got an audited report, it happens to be different than a calendar year, they could go ahead and use that fiscal report instead. We expect to bring forward an additional legislative concept to you for the 2014 session to address some additional improvements. We want to work those through a little more with ESA payers, having to do with, for example, reporting the gross operating revenues earlier in the year to give folks a head up earlier. This is one of the areas that they've indicated they're interested in. We want to work with them on that, but we just need more time. We don't want to rush through a timeline that won't be tenable for all. With respect to the Energy Facility Siting Council, frankly, that's taking up most of the paper that you have in front of you. This is really about removing references to the Department of Administrative Services, which is something stakeholders have wanted to do for a while now. The bill simply describes more specifically what we have always been statutorily authorized to do and what we have been doing operationally. The amendment merely clarifies past and existing practice that ESA funds may be used only for services provided by, in this case, by Department of Administrative Services.
And Director, I want to interrupt you just for a minute to let you know we don't actually have an amendment in front of this committee that's ready to go. There are still amendments that are being worked on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you get the large document, you will note that it is long, and it is long in large part because of this provision. This is clearly a cleanup provision in terms of moving the Energy Facility Siting Council squarely into the Oregon Department of Energy. And similarly, with respect to the activities funded by the energy supplier assessment, the bill simply elaborates current statutory language by stating that the ESA funds programs and activities that the council and the department are charged with administering and authorized to conduct under statute. So while the new language may clarify that administration is covered, it really makes no substantive change in that regard to the current statute. So the main point here is that the intention of House Bill 2807 is to improve the predictability, transparency, and accountability of the department. That is something that I have pledged to do since the governor appointed me to my position at the end of 2012, so it's very aligned with the changes that I already have underway at the department and working with all of our stakeholders. I'm committed to our agency's mission to reduce the long-term cost of energy for Oregonians and providing excellent customer service, and I believe if we have a successful amendment to the bill, that the bill will help us rekindle our historically good relationships with all of our ESA stakeholders. Thank you.
Questions, this witness? I have one while others are thinking of them. Can you talk, we heard a little bit about the rate and the shall we say, outsized liability on the rate compared to where it's currently set. Can you talk about how that rate is determined?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the rate, we start off with the gross operating revenues of the energy resource suppliers under as defined under the law. And those rates, those gross revenues are currently reported on May 1st. The legislature, just like for any state agency, the legislature approves our authorized expenditure limit. Once we have that in place, we look at things, you know, our ending balance, and then we look at all of our other revenues, our federal funds, any other funds. We have a left cost recovery program, so all of our fees. And then 90 days after Sonny die, provide orders to the energy resource suppliers with their assessed amount. So it's based on our authorized expenditure limit set by the legislature, and then we deduct all of the revenues that we get from federal funds and all other fees and other sources of funds, and then they're allocated according to the energy resource suppliers' percent of the overall revenue.
Thank you. Further questions of the director? Seeing none, thank you for your testimony. Appreciate you coming over on short notice. Call up Justin Rainey, John Ledger, and Bruce Anderson, please. If Bruce is here, I didn't see him. Oh, there he is. Mm-hmm. Mr. Rainey.
Chair Bailey, members of the committee, For the record, Justin Rainey. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Metals Industry Council, the Northwest Food Processors Association, and also the industrial customers of Northwest Utilities. I'd like to start out by saying we, too, agree. We believe the direction the Department of Energy is going has been much improved, and we appreciate that. The industrial ratepayers have been working collaboratively with the utilities on this and the energy suppliers, and in our attempts to address the current problems with the energy supplier assessment. We share the same concerns that were raised during the public hearing last week, and a lot of the same concerns you've heard today. Our main goal is to bring transparency and clarity to the rate-setting process. We feel the agency should be accountable for the dollars that they collect, and that money should be spent on programs that do benefit those that are paying the assessment. We support more transparency in the rate-setting process. We feel that there should be stakeholder involvement in determining the program's benefits and criteria that should be supported based on the fee. We also feel very strongly that the rates that are assessed on the industrial ratepayers should be only used to pay for Department of Energy programs. So with that, I'll stop. You've heard a lot about the concerns today, and I understand conversations will continue. So we appreciate the work that you're doing in this, Chair Bailey, and look forward to those conversations continuing.
Thank you. Mr. Ledger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Ledger, Associated Oregon Industries. I'm just going to touch on fees briefly. We pay a lot of fees, primarily to the DEQ, actually hundreds of millions of dollars, and they often go up, and you rarely see a lot of conflict about it because there are ways to assess fees that will build support and also make the agency careful about how it goes about raising fees. You have to have three things when you do fees. You have to have a nexus between the fee and what's offered, and it might be permissive, like going into a park, or it might be regulatory. But it has to be. There has to be a nexus. There has to be a mechanism whereby the agency is—it's in its best interest to be very judicious about raising fees. That's in its best interest to do. And you also have to have a mechanism where it's in the best interest of the fee payers to engage with the agency early on in the fee raising process, so you guys don't get blindsided by whoever's going to pay the fees when it comes to you for approval. And there are mechanisms to do this. It's not hard. It's been done for years. I think the first thing is you have to have a mechanism where the agency identifies clearly why it needs to raise the fee, what it needs for FTEs, what it needs to have done. It then takes that to a stakeholder group or out to the greater community, whoever's going to pay the fees, and it presents that to them and essentially educates the fee payers on how they're going to go about what it is they're going to get for the fee increase. That often gets rid of about 80% of the friction on raising fees. It also makes the agency very careful about how they do it because they have to justify it. The next step comes down to the legislature where it's built into their budget, so you have to approval. So that's another process where people can comment on the fees, and if people haven't engaged early, they kind of get called on it. So you have some oversight then, and you get to see what they want to do. After that process, it goes to a rulemaking process. Initially, an informal rulemaking process. There's a lot of discussion with the stakeholders. Things are worked out, goes to a formal rulemaking process. The public gets involved. By that time, things are pretty much smoothed out. And then again, it comes back to you one more time for final approval and review, which is often, I'd say, almost 99% of the time, pro forma, because we've gone through this process. And it's kind of laborious, but it removes a lot of the friction in the fee process, and it makes the agency much more responsive to the fee payers, and it makes the fee payers engage early. And that's a model that could be employed, and it looks like it's going in the right direction.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bruce Anderson for Northwest Natural. Appreciate the chair's efforts and work on this issue. There's nothing really I will add to what's already been said. We just look forward to seeing things as they develop and look forward to seeing things when they're ready on Thursday. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you very much for your testimony. And finally, Brian Doherty, please. Oh, look at the time. Oh, no.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was not signed up before, and I appreciate you giving me the opportunity. And also, thank you for the work you're doing on this ESA issue. You've heard the two words accountability and transparency, and I'm not going to repeat those. They are important, something we've been talking about for years. What I found interesting in some of the proposed regs that I would like to just address very briefly. One, for example, our companies, I'm Brian Doherty, I represent the Western States Petroleum Association. For example, we pay fees to the Department of Agriculture to make sure that our pumps provide the fuel quality and the fuel quantity that you need. That's a nexus that I think ties to a fee that is very important. In this situation, I think it's important, again, to see this. I'd rather not talk about the past. I think it's good to look forward. I think one of the issues was that the ESA was not really set before the legislative budget committees. It was done sometime after, and I think it's important. I think in the concept that the chair is looking at, there is the idea that we should be setting forth the ESA fee before the budget committees and somehow line-iting them to what they are going to, so everybody can have a chance to input. And with that, I promise to be short, so I will end my testimony. Thank you very much.
Questions for this witness? Thank you very
Thank
much.
Thank you.
I would like to say for the record, I really appreciate all of the stakeholders that have come together to work on a very complex issue in a short amount of time, particularly the department, the governor's offices, and the representatives of both the investor-owned and consumer-owned utilities who have put an enormous amount of time into this, and as well as ratepayer advocates. And this is one that we are has been a perennial discussion. My hope is that we'll find some solutions this session that will help create some structural change going forward. But I really want to say again that I appreciate on an issue that had the potential to be one that carried with it a lot of emotion and heat that everybody has been able to set aside those feelings and be able to approach this very constructively and in a very solution-oriented way. And it speaks credit to the entire stakeholder community, to the department, and the governor's office working on this issue. So thank you to all of you. And with that, close the public hearing on House Bill 2807 and carrying over, just for the record one more time, the work session on 2807 to Thursday. And with that, colleagues, have we exhausted our agenda?
Yeah.
We are exhausted. Committee is adjourned.
Exhausted.